Welcome to Analyst Talk with Jason Elder. It's like coffee with an analyst, or it could be whiskey with an analyst reading a spreadsheet, linking crime events, identifying a series, and getting the latest scoop on association news and training. So please don't beat that analyst and join us as we define the law enforcement analysis profession one episode at a time.
Thank you for joining me. I hope many aspects of your life are progressing. My name is Jason Elder, and today our guest has 6 years of law enforcement analysis experience. He started as an investigator and analyst in New York before taking his talents to Delray Beach, Florida. He has a bachelor's in criminal justice from John Jay College of Criminal Justice. Please welcome Christopher Bruno. Chris, how are we doing?
Hey, Jason. Good. How are you?
All right. Very, very good.
Good. Thanks for having me on.
I'm still laughing about Bruno. That is such a classic last name of a New Yorker.
Yeah, it sure is. I hear a lot of it down here in Florida. They hear my name and they instantly know that where I'm from.
Yeah, that enforcer name, like you're the enforcer of New York, right? So yeah. We got a couple of things to go over here today. Obviously, we're going to talk about Chris's journey from New York to Florida. We also are going to take your calls. So we're going to play Don't Be That Analyst. So if you have a Don't Be That Analyst, get your calls in now. All right, Christopher, how did you discover the law enforcement analysis profession?
Well, it started for a while. I wanted to become a cop since growing up. I have family in the law enforcement industry. That's something I always wanted to do. I had a few setbacks with color blindness, kind of limited where I wanted to go. So I had to find alternative routes into the law enforcement industry. Spent a lot of time as an investigator doing private investigations, working for the city of New York in the investigative aspect. And I saw an opening as a crime analyst and just thought of it as a way into the police department, kind of around that colorblindness area. And I was able to come in when the NYPD was starting their crime control strategies unit of bringing in analysts with various backgrounds. I got to work and learn under Deborah Peel, who is, I guess you would say, one of the OG analysts, kind of yes. Very experienced. She's great. And so I was fortunate enough to learn under her, got my feet wet in that and kind of got the ball rolling. And I got a lot of experience in New York and it was starting to look for a little bit of a change in atmosphere. My parents had moved down to Florida and it was something that I've always loved coming down here and being in the nice weather every day of the year, no shoveling snow, no cold storms. So I was able to convince my wife and she finally, after a lot of convincing, I was able to get her to come down here as well. And we kind of made it right before COVID got shut down and everything. So it kind of worked out that we were able to find a place down here before everything happened and just been trucking along ever since Delray Beach and giving them everything that I got.
Excellent. So a couple of follow-up questions to all that. So the color blindness, I have been tested and I know for certain colors that I am colorblind. I don't think I realized that there was a restriction on colorblindness for a police exam, though. So do you have a degree of, are you more colorblind than me? Or like, do you know how that's rated?
Listen, I say colorblindness and my mother always kicks me saying it's not a color blindness, it's a color deficiency. I'm not fully colorblind. It's probably what you have. It's a red-green color deficiency. So there are certain shades of the colors that I can't see, but I've done multiple physical examinations. I did NYPD, a couple agencies out in Long Island. And when I go to do the medical test, they stick you in that machine where you look through and you got to find the number, yeah, circle, and just that from then on, they're like, wait, you can't see that? Wait, you have a color blindness? Fail. So, and this is mid-2000s. So I know a lot has changed in the law enforcement practices of accepting certain types of people, I guess you could say. So yeah, if I wanted to now become a cop, I probably could, but I think I found my profession already.
Yeah. I know mine's, it has to do with purple. There's a purple. It's usually the purple background, and of course I can't see the number, so I don't know what the number is, but I always wanted to figure it out and make a sign in my house that everybody else could read but me. Something real snarky. But yeah. Anyway, so I'm curious, as you start out your career, you have a couple of stops. You talked about private investigator. Let's start there. We're going to work our way to you being an investigator for the housing and preservation and development. And so with those jobs, like, so what did you learn? What were you picking up? Because you're just starting out. You're in New York. So what did you learn along the way?
So as a private investigator, I worked for a company that mostly dealt with like insurance fraud. Mm-hmm. So someone gets injured on the job and they say, oh, my arm is broken. I can't come to work and do manual labor. Meanwhile, maybe they're at home and they're shoveling their driveway. So we would go out into the field and we would basically follow people around. It's kind of creepy.
Oh.
But that's what we did. We would follow them around, making sure that they're not doing anything that could contradict their injury, or if they're going to their doctor's appointments, we're spying on them and making sure they're actually going to their doctor's appointments and they're wearing that sling that they're supposed to be wearing, that there's no fraud going on. Then we would kind of report back. And normally it doesn't seem as difficult, but when you're working in New York City and you have multiple methods of transportation, you could be in your car and all of a sudden this person decides he wants to jump on the subway. So you got to quickly find a parking space, which in New York City is very limited.
Mm-hmm.
So then you got to jump on the train. And if he wants to go from Brooklyn all the way up to the Bronx, you're going to follow him and record every move. So it was an interesting job. I actually enjoyed it. And it was very fun. Everything was always changing. You're always on your toes. And it was also a lot of time management because you had multiple cases that you had to work. So you had to organize your schedule and make sure that you're getting things done in appropriate time manner. So that was an interesting job.
Hmm. So I should have asked you this in the beginning. So what do you consider your hometown?
My hometown, Rome, New York, which is central New York, mm-hmm. about an hour away from Syracuse,
okay.
Right smack dab in the middle of the state. And then I ended up moving to the city when I was a little older, went back to school. My brother had been living there, so I thought it was a good opportunity to kind of invade his living space and live with him.
Okay, so you were at least familiar with the city prior to having these jobs. Like, you knew your way around even prior to having these investigators.
Yeah, I had lived in the city for a couple of years prior to becoming an investigator.
Okay. When you said that, you read on the resume, private investigator, I didn't think it would be actually tracking people as they move. You described it. So I was like, oh, that's way more fun than what I thought it was going to be, right?
Hiding in the bushes and wearing conspicuous costumes. It was interesting.
Big trench coat and a hat, right?
Oh, yeah.
Sunglasses. All right, good deal. So then what about the housing preservation and development?
Yeah, so that unit was responsible for like code enforcement for like buildings. So say you had an issue with your apartment building, you report it, they come to make sure that everything's fixed by your landlords. And so they had started this investigations unit that would kind of monitor the various aspects of not only inspectors, but the landlords as well. And I kind of took my experience as a private investigator into this role and to kind of, it wasn't as secretive. I didn't have to like secretly follow, but it was a lot of kind of checks and balances. You're making sure that the workers are actually going to their stops and actually going to the building when they say that they're there, you know? So it's kind of fraud related in a similar role as like investigating why maybe a problem in a certain building wasn't getting fixed. So we'd have to also reach out to like landlords and stuff like that.
Hmm. Yeah, that is interesting. And then do you have any, I mean, between either of them, do you have a favorite story you like to tell?
Well, I don't want to say it's a favorite story, mm-hmm. but there was a lot of instances where you would go into one apartment and just when you think that there wasn't one worse than that one, you would just find yourself in one worse. And then when I say worse, I mean hoarders. You go into places where there's cockroach infestations and rats and stuff. And so like you kind of don't know what to expect when somebody opens their door. So it's not really a favorite story, but it's kind of like you don't realize the way things are the way people live, like, you don't know that until you actually see it for yourself firsthand. It was kind of eye-opening.
Yeah, I can imagine that. It is just the idea of it. And yeah, as you said, you never knew what the next one was going to show you.
Yep.
So then from there, though, so you're taking the path from an investigator. And as you mentioned, you did try to get in with some of these police departments. What turned your attention to an analyst with NYPD?
Well, one of my coworkers at the time when I was working for the housing department, he was aspiring to be a law enforcement officer, and just having conversations with him, it kind of like got my mind, got the gears turning on being a part of a law enforcement agency. And so at the time, I kind of started looking for other positions and kind of wanted to kind of expand a little bit. And I came across this posting and I saw NYPD crime analyst. And I thought to myself, well, what is that? Mm-hmm. I didn't know anything about the field. And I started reading the job description and it just sounded like an investigations job. Like, it just sounded like you're a detective. That's all detective work. You're researching offenders and looking up crime. It's trying to figure out who, what, where, when, and why. And it just sounded so interesting. And fortunate enough for me, I was able to apply, interview, and get the job.
So what was the interview process like?
It was just talking about my experiences, my work history, and kind of what I brought to the table at the time. Mm-hmm. And as I mentioned before, NYPD was looking at crime analysts with various backgrounds. Mm-hmm. So whether you have an extensive history in fraud or, you know, private investigations and doing the research and whatever it may be, they kind of wanted to have a melting pot of skill sets. So mm-hmm. I was able to fit one of those skill sets.
Hmm. Yeah, then you obviously know the area and had the different contacts there, whether it was with the housing or with insurance. So now I can see where that got you in the door, so to speak. Once you get there, you know, where are you assigned? What are the issues? What are the tasks that you're assigned?
So I was assigned to the 6-0 precinct, which is in Coney Island. It was a beautiful place to work. great people. And again, it seems like every time I get a job, I'm fortunate enough to have supervisors and bosses that are just amazing and have a lot of knowledge. And that's kind of what the 6-0 precinct was able to provide. My crime analysis unit, it was myself. We had a sergeant and two sworn officers in the office as well. So I was able to learn a lot. It was just a great experience. And, you know, it was kind of heartbreaking to leave because they were such great people. But yeah, they had a lot to offer for me.
Yeah. Now, we talked about a little bit in the prep call in terms of the Analysis Academy. Do you go through that before you even step foot there in Coney Island, or are you there at Coney Island and then you go back to training? How does that work?
So it was, I guess you would call it a crime analyst class. We were the second class and you get sent to the police academy. So you actually go to the NYPD's police academy and you're in a classroom setting. It was about a week and a half. Mm-hmm. So they were teaching us the various, you know, programs that they use and just kind of getting us acclimated to the NYPD. And then from there, once we finished our training, you kind of selected where you would like to go. Obviously, you want to go to the precinct that you live closest by. And that was one of them. And then so once they decide where you're going to go, they gave you that list and then you reported there the following week.
So out of that week and a half long training, how much time was spent on CompStat?
every minute of the day. So, and that's kind of what our job function, not all of it, but what our main job function was at each precinct was kind of being the person to prepare the CompStat book, as they called it, which was probably a 8-inch thick binder with all the stats and yeah, stuff. So that, like, preparing for that was pretty cool. As tedious as it sounds and working late hours, it's fun because you're in your unit with your crime analysis team, just putting together all this information that you know that when CompStat comes, the material that your commanding officer's presenting, you gave that to him. So it's very rewarding.
What now, how often was your team up for CompStat?
Not as often as some. Mm-hmm. However, because we were in the Bronx South, we did have areas that were up more frequent, which meant that because they were up, we were up. So it was at least once a month.
All right. So I think you mentioned Deb Peel before, and when I had her on the show, I thought it was fascinating because she really went into CompStat and the process, and really it's the idea of identifying patterns and trends. I think she said maybe specifically patterns, and then assigning a number to those patterns and making sure that it's worked up and taken off from there. You find a pattern and you work the pattern.
Yep. Yep. And you know, that's kind of what all you do. I mean, you really assist everybody within your department at tackling that problem. So whether it's car brakes in a certain area, you're trying to provide and you're trying to help out with getting all the possible subjects involved, time of day of the week, and all the specifics to be able to give to your commanding officer that he can then go and say, all right, jump out team, let's go to this area, let's try to solve this problem.
Yeah. And you just mentioned it. It took me a second to realize what you said. Are they still dealing with 3-ring binders? Or are they, I mean, have they got everything electronic by now? I would hope so.
So it's weird. NYPD, if you go to a precinct, for example, the 6-0, if you go into their basement, they still have all their handwritten reports. Mm-hmm. And as far as I know, they're still doing double. So you have your handwritten report it gets entered into the system.
Oh, wow.
So, yeah.
Yeah. I think it's funny that aspect, too, about police departments. And I think I ran into this with every police department I ever worked with or even talked to and got a tour of their facility. There's certain aspects of a police department where it's cutting edge technology and it's ooh and ah, and it's awesome to look at. And then there's just this other aspect that they're like way like 30, 40, 50 years behind everybody else.
Yes.
Not everybody has all the shiny bells and whistles. And it's kind of refreshing that NYPD is in that same boat as well.
Right. Especially since they have all the shiny bells and whistles.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. Because I always talk about Cincinnati Police Department where we had a lot of good technology and we were testing a lot of new technology for different vendors. And then we had this big book where we kept our time. I guess admin staff had to actually take roll and put your days in this big book. It looked like this big Smurf book or whatever. It was ginormous. And I was like, I can't believe that's the way we take time here when we have all this other great technology going on. So as you're starting out and you're getting it, what was the biggest obstacle for you?
I would say advancement. But seemed like NYPD, it's such a giant machine and there's a lot of moving parts. And there's a lot of crime analysts within that agency. So one goal that I had was to obviously excel at what I did, but have it be recognized to the level of promotion and moving up to different levels as a crime analyst. Mm-hmm. And so that was, I think, probably the biggest obstacle is kind of making your work, I guess, known because you're at a decent precinct. There's not a lot of crime or at least the crime is better than, say, like a precinct up in the Bronx who they're at CompStat all the time. They're always having problems. So they're constantly under watch. And so if there's good work being done, it's being watched by the most active precinct. So the fact that we were pretty decent, we were kind of under the radar. So I kind of had to find ways to overcome that obstacle and kind of stand out from the rest.
So then what types, you talked about being at CompStat maybe once a month. So when you weren't prepping for CompStat, what kind of tasks were you getting into there at the precinct?
Prepping for the next CompStat.
No,
I'm joking. So every week we would put together not a CompStat report, but we would put together a weekly overview of kind of what's been going on. We're tracking the various crimes in the precinct and just kind of keeping tabs on what's going on. So that way, in the event that maybe we are called for CompStat, we kind of have those answers ready. And then we also get the patterns that, you know, that are happening, and we're trying to find out offenders and, you know, looking at that stuff. But it's a lot of research going on from a week to week basis.
Yeah. One of the downsides, I think, of CompStat is it turned folks into just almost the same level as like factory workers. Like you talked about, you joked around about next week. I mean, I've saw places where I was like, okay, Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday was prepping for CompStat on Thursday. Friday, you were doing some odd and ends, sharpening the saw, but then Monday was the same process, rinse, repeat type thing. And it was back when you had the 3-ring binders. So you're getting those and you're creating 10 binders with printing all that out. And it just kind of made it more of a machine. And then you kind of wondered, where's the analysis and all that if you're just doing all this clerical stuff?
Right. And that's some of the problems, not problems, but some of the reasons kind of why I decided to go to a smaller agency, just because of that. You're kind of like just another analyst spitting out numbers at this precinct along the rest, like you said, like a factory.
Yeah. I can see why it still works at NYPD, because I think it does get back to the idea of patterns. But I think a lot of departments tried to duplicate CompStat. It seems like almost everybody tried some form of CompStat. But it does seem like it's, if you're just reporting out on crime, back when this was started 20, it's more like 30, 40 years ago now, the stats weren't readily available. So you almost had to come to this meeting to know the stats. Now, I mean, you nobody's waiting for the meeting to get the stats. You're getting the stats first moment you wake up in the morning, you're getting all the stats. So I think in a way, for those that created CompStat with this idea that you were just going to get the stats and talk about them, I think it can get stale really, really quickly, that meeting, because people aren't waiting a week or waiting a couple of days they're barely waiting an hour to get the data, let alone a week.
Right. You could get those numbers and you click a button and boom, everything's automated and you have that report in a minute.
Yeah. So, all right. Well, you mentioned it in the beginning of this interview about the reasons you've followed your folks to Florida, but it had to be pretty big shell shock for you being from New York. When you started this NYPD, you knew New York pretty well, as we established, but then now you are really a fish out of water heading down to Delray Beach.
it took some adjustment, and just like as I already mentioned, having a good group of people you work with. Again, I was fortunate enough to have another good group of people to work with that kind of made that transition very easy for me. They laughed a lot when I would come down here and I started throwing out my New York slang terms, collars instead of arrests and a burg instead of a burglary, and they'd laugh at me. But no, it was a good group, and it made things very easy.
Yeah. Now, you mentioned a smaller department. Did you purposely seek out a smaller jurisdiction as opposed to trying to go to one of the bigger cities here in Florida?
I was actually not looking at the size of the agency initially. Mm-hmm. My main goal was to get down to Florida. I did my research on what were the larger agencies. You have like the sheriff's office. The thing is, it runs a lot differently down here than New York, whereas it's such a big city. Mm-hmm. Whereas down here, you have a bunch of small cities and then you have the sheriff's office. So the jurisdictions are a lot different. And once I kind of started doing a little more research and I realized how many officers were belonging to each police department and the various types of crimes and stuff, I thought that it would be a better benefit for my skills to go to an agency that was smaller. And I just kind of at that point knew that all agencies down here were a lot smaller than New York. So I think I didn't really plan on hitting up a small agency.
Yeah. Now, you mentioned it, too, that this is March of 2020 that you're making this move. You started at Delray Beach in March of 2020. So had you already got the job and everything else before COVID and we had the big shutdown, or did that happen after?
Well, funny enough is that in 2019, this was kind of when I was able to convince my wife to get on board with moving down here. I had saw an opening in Delray because my parents were down here at the time. Mm-hmm. I applied. I went through the whole process. I was offered the job. However, this was in January and mm-hmm. we were getting married in May. And so we had all of our wedding plans, everything done, and we were getting married up there in New York. And so that was kind of the deal breaker. And mm-hmm. they weren't willing to kind of negotiate the timing mm-hmm. of waiting, which I understood. You got to do what you got to do. And mm-hmm. so I had to, unfortunately, decline. And so fast forward a year later, I get a phone call from one of the captains. And he's like, hey, are you still interested in the job? I said, of course I am. And so we kind of got the ball rolling from there. But yeah, it was right before COVID started looking at homes in like January, February. We were down here spending some time getting ready to move. And it was our last trip back up before we started our entire move. And that's when the rumbles of this new disease came about mm-hmm. and things started to get shut down slowly. And we kind of just said, well, we gotta hurry up here and get our stuff down and go.
So you hustled up, finished New York, and we're in Delray by the time everything was shut down.
Yep.
Nice.
I think I was working here by the time we were shutting down. I had already been working here for about maybe 3 months or so.
Mm-hmm. So does that mean that they hired somebody else and it didn't work out? Like you talked about 2019. I'm always fascinated about when I hear people's stories, and I'm like, well, that's kind of serendipitous, isn't it? Like, that just worked out well for you, but that obviously means that if they weren't willing to wait weeks, I doubt it. They waited a year. Yes. So I'm guessing that somebody didn't work out. And so that opened the door for you.
Yes, that is exactly right. Somebody didn't work out. And fortunately enough, I think instead of having to go through the whole hiring process again, they just picked up that phone and made the call. So, but yeah, fortunate for me.
So then certainly it's a smaller jurisdiction, total different state, and getting acclimated to the weather and everything else. But I guess when you get there, what are they trying to accomplish with this position?
Well, it was a little strange at first. When I first got here, I kind of had really no direction mm-hmm. in the very beginning. And that's because, so at the time, there was one analyst there. And when I came on board, that analyst was in the process of leaving. So I didn't really get too much training. Fortunately, I did have a good supervisor, a sergeant at the time. He is a military intelligence guy. So he, as far as like strategy and intel and planning and things like that, he was very good at that. And that's kind of where the goal was of that unit, and kind of where he wanted me to fit in was more on the intelligence side, and trying to, instead of the CompStat ways of doing things with spitting out numbers and data, was more intel-based with trying to locate offenders, you know, locations in the city where crimes are occurring, try to figure out why they're occurring. And it was definitely what led me to really enjoying the job that I do.
It sounds like you had more freedom. You weren't pigeonholed.
Yes. And it was great because the NYPD, as I said, there's 100 different analysts, and you have your auto theft units, you have your homicide divisions, you have all these different things that are going on, and it's that one person's job responsibility. When I came here, all of that was on me, and it was great to know that I could be doing auto thefts and homicides, shootings, burglaries, and all sorts of crimes, and it was all mine, and I could get my hands on it. It was great.
Now, did you have to do CompStat? Do they have some kind of CompStat meeting you had to prep for?
No, I mean, so before I got there, yes, they did. And uh-huh. from all the stories that I've heard, it didn't go over so well. Mm-hmm. And then so by the time I got there, that was kind of kicked to the curb. And mm-hmm. yes, we would provide stats because obviously it's important. And at the end of the day, numbers don't lie. But it was more intel based. But we would meet on a weekly basis. We still do. We have our weekly mm-hmm. meetings. So we'll provide crime stats, what's going on in our city, and then we do a deeper dive into the intel of why things are happening into our city. So,
mm-hmm. Yeah. So now is it, I guess, in terms of the size of the city and number of crimes and everything else, I mean, that's probably the equivalent of a precinct, I would imagine, in New York City.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And that was the nice thing about going from a place like the 6-0 is going to Delray Beach. It felt almost the same. You have your beach crimes, you have your downtown area, and then you have your residential area. So it's just kind of like a good mix.
Be on the lookout for a new show, Cocktails and Crime Analysis, hosted by Charlie DiBerti, Chris Delaney, and yours truly. Each time we will talk crime analysis while sipping our favorite drink. Join us for our very first episode this Wednesday, April 24th. Here's a little preview of what's in store.
On this week's show, we'll discuss the ILEA conference agenda and we'll all share our biggest conference presentation fails. We'll discuss cool applications for ChatGPT for crime analysts, and it's the 30th anniversary of the first ever CompStat meeting. Deb Peel from NYPD is going to stop by to discuss the legacy of CompStat and our favorite alternate names for it. So pour yourself a drink and let's get started.
All right, very good. Well, this brings us to your analyst badge story. And for those that may be new to the show, the analyst badge story is the career defining case or project that an analyst works. So we're here 2022, and you're dealing with a unique crime series, I'll put it that way.
Yes, it was very unique. So just a brief backstory on this particular crime, and it's kind of made waves throughout the state of Florida for sure, and it definitely hits other big places. So these females would go to bars, nightclubs. They would intentionally meet male, older male, I guess you would call victims. They would kind of smooze them a little bit and flirt with them and make them seem like they're actually interested. Hey, let's go back to my apartment or go back to my hotel. The female, they'd mix a drink at the place. They would put a drug in it, knock the guy out and steal his Rolex, take his phone, deposit all the money out of the bank accounts. And so that started an uptick in Delray Beach, mostly because of COVID. During the time, Miami was shut down, Fort Lauderdale was shut down, mm-hmm. and Delray Beach was open for business. And so a lot of the criminals from down there kind of worked their way up here. And we didn't really have much information. We were getting cases coming in. The victims were waking up, not remembering what happened. The only thing they know is they met someone downtown and went back to their place. And that's all they know. Not a lot of cameras to work off of. So I was able to discover through various investigative means, looking at other agencies who may have similar cases. A lot of times we would have the incident occurring in Delray Beach, but they go back to their place in Boca Raton, and that gets reported to the Boca Raton Police Department, but we don't know about it because, well, it just didn't happen to occur in Delray, you know? So there's a lot of research in this particular crime. I was looking at traffic stops, LPR hits, different things like that, just to kind of try to identify. And I was able to identify the ring of females as well as their ringleader, the vehicles that they're using, known associates, where they're going. I was able to track them, get in touch with other agencies and let them know kind of what was going on so they could be prepared. And we ended up making multiple arrests. It was a big statewide case. I earned a couple awards, Employee of the Month for that, as well as a Kiwanis Club Award.
Nice.
For those efforts. So it was pretty cool.
Yeah. So the victims, when they woke up, where did they wake up? Did they move the bodies once the folks were knocked out? Or were they waking up in just strange hotel rooms?
They would wake up wherever they were. So if they were the snowbirds coming down and partying, they're in their hotel room. Or if they were a resident of the area, they'd wake up in their bed. So they weren't like taken from anywhere else. So they were always bringing them back to their place. and then they'd have a cocktail. The girl would make the drink. And as soon as they pass out, boom, they'd be off with their stuff.
Man. Okay. I misunderstood you. I was thinking that the girls had the hotel rooms and they were going back to the girls' apartments. So the okay, that makes sense. And so then, this means that they had full access to the house. They could steal anything.
Yes, essentially. So you would have the occasional, I don't know why you would start showing people your property or, but they would have safes that they would open up and they would show them what's in the safe and things like that. It was, people, they don't think, I mean, if you look at some of these victims, obviously not judging, but they're older males, and the girls, that they're young, attractive females, and they're very, I guess you would say, vulnerable to having someone show interest in them, and that's why they get away with it.
So that is a lot then. So where were they getting the drugs?
They would carry it in on their person in their purse. What we found out was that they would actually putting the drug in like an eye drop container. Like, so it looks like eye drops. And so that was another thing that we were able to discover just through collaboration with other agencies, particularly Miami PD, who have encountered this, and there's multiple cases down there. But yeah, they would have the eye drop container inside of their purse, and that's where they would mix it into the drink.
All right. Cause I'm just thinking that in terms of the logistics of pulling this crime off, right? So, cause I can understand wooing him back, the victim back to his place, but then you got to get your hands on this drug that's going to knock him out.
Yep. And that was probably the hardest part of solving the case, because even though they're drugged, it's not easy to prove, because you have to do a full toxicology on the victim. And if you don't know to do that, you're not thinking that they were drugged. You just assume that maybe they drank too much and they kind of passed out.
Oh, man. So do you remember offhand what was the largest take of a victim? What was the most that was stolen?
Well, we've had a lot of Rolexes. I can't remember the exact brand, but there was one watch that was over $300,000, which was, I didn't know they made watches to be that expensive. I'll have a watch that maybe I spent $30 on that.
Not more than a house. That's
sure. Right.
Oh, man. So that's a lot. So do you still have these cases? Does these things still happen from time to time, or?
Yes, they still do happen. On the positive note is that we have a running list of suspects. So whether it happens in our jurisdiction or a neighboring agency, we're able to kind of provide whatever information we can. It's still difficult just because there's not much really to work off of unless we get a good description. Believe it or not, some of the females had some more distinct features. One of our cases, it was actually a male dressed as a female. So there's a lot of different variations that make it sort of difficult to kind of crack the case.
I got you. And I think you mentioned this in the prep call, is like this has turned into a ring type thing where you have a leader, pimp style, kind of coordinating this type of crime.
Yep. It makes it very hard to connect. We were luckily able to obtain phone search warrants on some of the girls. And even though we're able to establish that the girls are communicating with these pimps, it's just they're so good at hiding the actual information that you have nothing really to prove that the pimp was telling the girls to do X, Y, and Z. So while we did make arrests on a lot of the girls, the pimps are always, they get off scot-free.
Interesting. So, okay. Well, very good. All right. And before we move on, you were recently featured in a magazine, the Delray Beach Village by the Sea magazine. Is that correct?
Yeah, that's correct. It was a nice honor to be featured in there, to be recognized for the work that I do and how I contribute my knowledge and skills to the Delray Beach Police Department.
So did they reach out to you? Did somebody recommend you? How did you get the link to the magazine?
They recommend each, like season, they'll put out a new magazine. And for each magazine, they feature certain members of the police department, civilian employees as well. And so I was recommended by our staff.
Very good. And I will put a link in the show notes for the article. All right, let's move on to some advice for our listeners now. I guess for those that are listening, whether they're a new analyst or an experienced analyst, what advice do you have for them?
I think my biggest thing is to kind of expand your skill set, the journey that I've been through and the obstacles that I've had to overcome, I think can be attributed to the various experience that I've had in training, aside from running numbers and data. I think it takes a lot more type of skills to be a crime analyst than just your average. And that was kind of where the NYPD, I think, exceeded in acquiring people with different backgrounds. And so if I had to give good advice, it would be go do a training that you're something that interests you that could relate to your job, go do it. If you want to learn something new, go do it, because at the end of the day, all your training is going to come back to this position.
Yeah. And speaking of training, I'm just looking at your resume here, your list of training. Do you have a favorite training or a training that you highly recommend?
I think the biggest trainings that benefited me the most was my investigations trainings. You kind of learn what it's like to be an investigator, kind of that mindset of like digging into things. And I think that plays a huge role in what we do, because we always want to find out the who, what, where, when, and why. And I think that's an essential skill set, good training to have under your belt.
Yeah. And it seems like one of the things you struggled with at NYPD was standing out a little bit, right? And there's certainly, as analysts, you produce products, you try your best, you have a couple of people that champion your work and get to working with them. But in a scenario, in a situation like NYPD, it can be a struggle to stick out with. There's so much going on, so many people. And not only you're competing with all those folks, you're competing with other analysts. What would your advice be at just trying to stand out with your work?
I think being competitive with your work could make you stand out. You have other analysts that you work with, or if you're with a small agency and maybe it's just yourself, but you do work closely with maybe sworn personnel and you're all doing similar type products, and one person might show you something they're working on, and it should be in your mind that you want to do yours, but better than that. You always want to show that your work is better than the other person's. And it's hard to say that, treat it like a competition, because at the end of the day, you're on the same team. But I think in this aspect, it's only going to benefit your agency as well, because if everybody's trying to put together the best product, your agency is going to succeed. And then I think your product that you do is going to stand out from everybody else's.
Yeah. And you're gonna annoy all the other analysts. So, I remember seeing that happen, where it's like, oh, one new analyst came along and his colors and color combinations looked so much better than everybody else's, and they're just like, oh, I gotta keep up with him, and it annoyed them. I was like, oh, I just want to use what I normally use, not have to make it look so pretty. But you're right in terms of the overall department. Yes, the department benefits from that competition, but then as another analyst, you're like, oh, I don't want to get into that competition.
I've been there before too. It's like somebody comes in and it's just, you got to be accepting of, you have to think about it not as competition, like, oh, this person, I have to be better than them. You kind of have to work together, and like while you're competing for hierarchy, at the end of the day, you're at the same level, you're doing the same things, and you have to treat it as like you're taking advice from somebody too.
As you get established as an analyst, you become, maybe an expert might be too strong a term, but you find your niche, right? You find that out, like what you're good at and what your piece of the pie is. and what you're constantly being asked to do. If what you want to do is what you're being asked to do, you're a happy camper. But if it's not, then that's when you have to find your way to, like, okay, how can I expand my expertise, my knowledge, to get into doing the task that I do want to do. My advice, if you're in that situation, would be just hustle it up, work a little bit extra, find out as much as you can about those particular tasks, find your opening there to make a difference. And I think once you start doing that, people see your value. Everybody talks about it on the show. It's like you just need one person to be your champion, and then the word of mouth spreads from there. So that would be my advice to there if you're stuck, if you feel that you're stuck in that position. All right, so let's take some calls. As I mentioned in the beginning of the show, we are going to hear the Don't Be That Analyst. So first on the line is Jennifer. Jennifer, what's your Don't Be That Analyst?
Don't be that analyst that doesn't proofread or peer review your product before distributing.
we get that from time to time, right?
Yep.
So actually, it was just the other day, a couple weeks ago, that I brought back an email that I sent. I figured out how to do that in Outlook, how you can revert back and unsend essentially the email. And it was something I never did in my whole 20 plus years of being in an office, having an office job. But there is that capability that you can unsend emails. But to her advice is you should go out correct the first time.
Yes, definitely need, even if you got to pass it off to a colleague to proofread it, even if you think it's perfect, you got to do it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Even if that colleague's your biggest competitor, right?
Right.
Next on the line is Annette. Annette, what's your Don't Be That Analyst?
Don't be that analyst that's afraid to ask for help when you're learning something new. When I started in narcotics, a detective came up to me asking for help finding Charlie, and I thought that was a person's first name. And he laughed at me and said, no, that's slang for confidential informant. It took me a minute, but we all laugh about it now. But don't be that analyst that's afraid to ask questions.
Yeah. So Charlie, so you know that lingo. You brought that lingo down to Delray Beach, right?
Yes. I was definitely that person throwing this lingo and everybody looks at you like you got two heads.
Yeah.
But yeah, you gotta ask for help. It's huge.
And I struggle with this myself. And even, as I said, being an office worker for 20 plus years. And look, if I've identified it that I'm not supposed to know it, I'm fine with asking a question and trying to understand. But every once in a while, I'd get in that scenario where I was like, man, maybe I'm supposed to know this. So I'm like uncomfortable, especially in a bigger group, of asking for help with the not wanting to be embarrassed with people thinking like, oh, isn't he supposed to know that type thing? So yep. I still struggle with it because there's that anxiety of maybe I'm supposed to know this stuff.
And then if you don't know it, and then later on, you're like, wait a minute, I should have paid attention, or maybe I should have asked that question. And now I look even more like an idiot because now I'm completely clueless.
Yeah. I mean, well, in that scenario, I'd usually stay pretty quiet in that bigger group and then take it offline. I'm like, okay, I'm going to call a colleague, call a friend and say, hey, did you know that? And they'll say, no, I didn't know that. And I was like, okay, if I'm not alone, then I'm not afraid, that type of thing. If I'm not the only one, then I'm good with then asking a bunch of questions and trying to figure out offline. So,
right.
All right. Next on the line is Austin. Austin, what's your Don't Be That Analyst?
Hey, Jason, the Don't Be That Analyst that I have would be, don't be that analyst that operates in a silo, whether that be within your own department or within a collaborative group of fellow analysts in your region. If your distribution lists are the same for longer than 2 years or your products look the same in that same time frame, it's time to change some things up.
What do you think of that?
I definitely agree. I actually just got done changing some of my stuff around because I gave it that old 2 year look and I said, well, I think it's time for a little bit of change.
Yeah. In the beginning of that, when he's talking about operating in a silo, it also makes me what we were just talking about as well with being competitive, right? There's a certain line you don't cross when you're being competitive with your fellow coworkers as analysts. That's definitely not something that you want to be hiding see their skills or data to try to get the leg up on your coworker type of thing. So that's definitely a don't be that analyst there. Don't be competitive, but don't let it get the better of you, right?
Yes.
Next on the line is Allison. Allison, what's your don't be that analyst?
Don't be that analyst that steals work from another analyst. I think it's always better to collaborate on something than try to take something out from someone.
Yeah, that's that kind of the same thing with being competitive.
Yeah, and I got to say, just to add on to that, I don't want to say guilty of doing that, but We do work closely with other people, and if that person that you're working with or maybe from a neighboring jurisdiction has a product that is phenomenal and you like it, it's okay. As long as ask permission. You could say, hey, listen, I like what you do. I like what you put out. Do you mind if I kind of take some of the ideas that you have and be able to use it on my own? If they give you the okay, sure, go ahead. So yeah, I could see you definitely don't just take it and turn it into your own product for sure. Definitely give them the recognition.
I think it is various levels. If you're at a conference and someone's presenting and you see their color combination on something, that's what it's there for. You're supposed to, something like that. But I would say where the line is definitely when you're taking credit for something that maybe not fully be yours or not yours at all, right? To make, to make yourself look good, and getting back to that competitive nature, like there's just a line that you just don't cross. Just come up to that line, but don't cross it type thing. All right. Last but certainly not least is Carrie. Carrie, what's your don't be that analyst?
All right. Don't be that analyst that shoved numbers down people's throats. Know that they much prefer pretty pictures instead.
What do you think of that one?
Yeah, that's a good one. That was me when I first came to Delray Beach, and I was like, oh, Compstat. not a lot of people like that.
here's your binder. Yeah, so I think your point, though, about pretty pictures, though, is certainly interesting, because I think that's one thing that I even struggled with, and I see other analysts struggle with presentation. And whether that's at a Comstat meeting presenting in front of a group, or they're writing up a bulletin or an email, is selling that idea, and that people are going to tune you out if it's boring, right? And you want to find your way to add color to that and catch their attention, to tell the story. And so I think that particular one is short, but there's actually a lot to her advice there.
Definitely. You got to know your audience.
All right. So that's don't be that analyst. If you have a don't be that analyst you want to share for the show, email us at leapodcasts@gmail.com. All right, Christopher, let's finish up with personal interests. And for you, you play ice hockey. Bruno plays ice hockey.
I do. I played hockey all throughout up to college. I still play once a week in an adult men's hockey league late at night. It's kind of my stress relief from sitting at the desk all day and fighting crime.
Please tell me that you still hold a record for like penalty minutes in a league.
No. Unfortunately, you get thrown out of the league if you do too much of that. So I pay to be in the league, so I got to behave.
Yeah. So how long have you been playing hockey?
I started playing when I was five or six. Yeah,
I know a couple of hockey players. I find the concept wild when you think about it, because there's a lot of logistics to it. It's an expensive sport with all the equipment. And then you're talking about ice time. I knew guys even when I was professionally in my 20s in Baltimore, they were playing at like midnight. Because that's the only time their league could get ice time was midnight. So that's when they played.
That is right. My games aren't that late, but they're on the borderline. They're usually like 10 o'clock, 10:30. Mm-hmm. So by the time you get out, get done, get home, it's probably about 12, 1 o'clock, and then I have to be up the next day to work at 6. But it's worth it, though. It's worth it.
Yeah. What position do you play?
I play center. Uh-huh. I was a goalie all throughout my career. Uh-huh. And then I kind of once I stopped playing college, I sold the equipment thinking I'm never going to play hockey again. And so, as you had already mentioned, it's a very expensive sport. So to recover all that goalie equipment, it's very pricey. So I opted to play center, which is fun because it's I get to score the goals instead of being the one that stops the goals. So
yeah, man, I had a buddy from a different town. He had another, one of his best friends was goalie for their hockey team in high school. And they used to, he would get in his goalie uniform and everything else and stand in front of the window. And they would throw hockey pucks at him. And he, obviously, he wouldn't want anything then because he'd break the window in his bedroom. And that's how he practiced. So, but all right. So, well, hey, does, how's the hockey in Delray? Because, I mean, I think most people assume, like, the best hockey is up north.
I'm always going to say hockey is better up north. Down here, I mean, it's new in Florida. Obviously, it's hot, ice melts, but it's picking up. I mean, you got the Florida Panthers. They've been making runs in the playoffs the last couple of years, and so a lot of people are sticking with it. And you get a lot of Northerners too that come down here and they want to watch hockey, and that's the local team. So, but it's getting bigger. I know there's a bunch of cops that their kids play ice hockey, and so we're always shooting the breeze about it.
Yeah, I think it's University Alabama, maybe Birmingham, one of those. It's not Maine, Alabama, but one of those smaller campuses, I think, in Alabama actually is usually ranked pretty high in college for hockey. So that's always catch my eye because I think it's weird that it's Alabama and it's a hockey kind of thing.
But, right.
Yeah. So, all right. Very good. And then just one last question. So what do you miss most about New York? Maybe food, maybe restaurant sites. What do you miss most?
Definitely the food. As an Italian myself and always getting the good Italian food, the pastries, and that's probably the biggest thing I miss about the city. Fortunately, there are some decent places down here that you could get yourself some good food, but yeah, nothing like the food in New York City.
All right, I'm in New York City and I need to get pizza. Where am I going?
That's tough. That is a tough question, because you could probably get the same answer from every New Yorker, is that it depends what kind of pizza you want. But you know, I didn't really have one spot that I liked. Honestly, even some of those $1 pizza slice places that are open like after the bars close are still better than some of the places down here.
So any of them, just yes. Get pizza, just yes. Get pizza.
Yeah. If you see a flock of people, a long line out the door, you know it's good.
There you go. All right. Very good. Well, our last segment to the show is Words to the World. This is where you can promote any idea that you wish. Christopher, what are your words to the world?
Just don't let anything keep you down. If you're confronted with an obstacle, just look forward and trying to find a way around it, push through it. In my relation with the colorblindness, I kind of had to find other ways around to achieving my dream, my goal, and set your mind to it, and you'll achieve it. You can do it if you set your mind to it.
Very good. Well, I leave every guest with, you've given me just enough to talk bad about you later. But I do appreciate you being on the show, Chris. Thank you so much, and you be safe.
Thank you. Thank you. You too.
Thank you for making it to the end of another episode of Analyst Talk with Jason Elder. You can show your support by sharing this and other episodes found on our website at www.leapodcasts.com. If you have a topic you would like us to cover or have a suggestion for our next guest, please send us an email at leapodcasts@gmail.com. Till next time, analysts, keep talking.